like meme. And so what's he do? He starts to say, I'm a writer, and he starts reading books. He takes on the difficult one. And then he's stuck. He's gradually getting more and more marginalized, like any writer today. Even Norman Mailer felt marginalized eventually, because it's irrelevant being a writer today.
Okay.
It's irrelevant to have ideas. It's not irrelevant to get on a radio show and be intellectual and talk ideas, but they don't have any staying power. No one's going to live by them like they did 100 years ago.
Right. But through all this...
Now, I don't want to get you depressed like 10 years ago, so we're trying...
but through all this, like, sort of tension, I guess, that you're kind of describing in Meltzer, you know, I mean, I just still don't understand how you can say through all of that, I mean, no ideas are coming out.
Well, it's...
I mean, if you look at the aesthetics of rock, I mean... I mean, you know, we will do this. We'll point to...
Yeah, we'll go into sentences. I've marked them.
We'll go into some sentences and stuff, but I mean...
There are ideas, but they're just glimmers. They're just references, tags to say, oh, remember when there was a Nietzsche and that meant something? Remember when there was Jean-Paul Sartre? He references, and then he's saying that all this comes to him, his intellectual epiphanies come to him when he's in the ecstasy and throes of a Petula Clark song or a Stone song or something.
Right.
A Barbara Lewis song. Like, he's trying to reconcile. How do you visualize what he's feeling on the tactile proprioceptive level, which is what rock does? It's not just an ear experience. It's a multi-sensory experience. And Fitting's Wake takes all the senses and implodes them and then tries to separate them, tease them out. That's why Fitting's Wake is rock and roll in print. Rock and roll is that synesthetic experience.
But why isn't something like Aesthetics of Rock or something that Greil Marcus or Robert Christgau writes, is it part of the conversation?
It is a trend. It's one-fifth of the process. If you accept that there's five senses, McLuhan said there's only four, but he thought touch was, tactility was not a particular sense, it was the interplay of senses. So you can say there's four senses if you take tactility as interplay, or you can say there's five senses, which is more mainstream, and not know what tactility is and just call the fifth sense touch. But when you're interplaying all the senses, that's when you get synesthesia. And definitely writing is one-fifth of the process. Architecture is another fifth. Dancing is another fifth. Music is a fifth. All four or five senses are interplaying. All extensions of those senses and institutional aspects are equally relevant, but it's all canceled out by the ecstasy of immediate communication that the electric environment gives us.
Okay.
McLuhan used to say, people aren't interested in what... and now I'm quoting McLuhan because that's easier for people to understand. And it's hard to understand me because I'm post-McLuhan, but just to keep this approachable, McLuhan used to say, people didn't turn on the radio to hear what's on. They turned on the radio to share the discarnate space because they knew everybody was in the space. It's like jumping into a pool. And
but see, someone, Greil Marcus has written comments to that effect. I mean, he's written about, I mean, he didn't use the same terminology as McLuhan maybe, but he would write about, you know, the impact of tuning in to the radio, knowing that other people were tuned in, and that was the thrill of the ride in some ways.
Okay, there it is. Total cyborg response. McLuhan didn't believe the medium was a message as a concept. He said people will more and more live as if the medium was the message.
People were more and more what, sorry?
Would live as if the medium was the message. They would live it. It wasn't an idea or something that he was for or against. He was just describing the weather. So here's Greil Marcus celebrating the medium of radio. And that's not a critical function. That's just celebrating Richard Nixon and the environment of capitalism. If you want to get ideological, that's just getting duped by the environment. Or saying, oh, maybe this beats capitalism. But it didn't beat capitalism, did it? And neither did capitalism survive, as we've seen the past year. But the interesting thing is that he is not providing a critical relationship to the ecstasy of sharing the same space as everybody else.
But see, Bob, here's something I never hear you go into with Ben, or I don't think all the time, excuse me, I've been listening to your stuff.
Yeah.
I've heard you talk about this. But the word emotion.
Well, don't I sound emotional? No, maybe I don't.
Okay, no, but...
I sound passionate.
I mean, is an emotional, like, why...
That's what I mean by ecstasy.
Why isn't an emotional, but why...
It is nothing but emotion in the electric 20th century. It is nothing but emotion, tribal emotion, and personal emotion.
But if every, not everyone, well, so maybe it is everyone, but if everyone is feeling a similar emotional response, we're all swimming in this stuff, why isn't it useful or important for someone to at least point out to some degree, well, this is my sort of slant on, you know, the stuff that we're swimming in or whatever, like, and you know, some will even sort of go a little further and try and explain, like, in a bigger picture. I mean, it, you know, in music criticism or rock criticism, you probably 99.5% of it is garbage. You'll get no argument from me on that.
It's no, just, but like, it's the emotional response. It's trying to articulate your emotion.
But what I'm saying is, what's the uselessness of someone doing that well? And if
wait a minute,
like,
doing what?
Someone like
doing
well,
what well? Being emotional.
describing the emotional response.
Oh well, we get that 24/7. An advertisement describes an emotional response to a product.
Yeah, but I'm not going to utilize my brain.
Okay, I think what you're saying, but you mean, let's try to figure out what you mean by emotion.
Okay. I guess what I mean by emotion in this case is, you know, I mean in the simplest way, it's like I feel what a song does to me or something. It has, if I'm DJing at a wedding or something, and, you know, the particular beat kind of moves me in a certain way, it does it to me, and it's like I'm swimming in it or whatever. So for me to then sort of like flip into my right hemisphere, I guess, my left hemisphere, and try and put that on the page and make it mean something or give it some sort of descriptive quality, that's what I'm kind of thinking of rock criticism.
Yeah, that is what happens.
But why is that a useless? Why is that a useless function? Because if it resonates with people, like, isn't it good if me as the reader, like, can, if someone else can describe that experience for me and I understand that emotion or that feeling, is there, there's nothing wrong with that resonance? Is there?
No, there's nothing wrong with any experience. But look at Ben. Ben's not getting any emotion out of mainstream media for decades, right?
Right, right.
He's mostly dead. He does find things he likes, but they're pretty obscure. He thinks they're obscure. So so he is not able to respond to the present and get emotional charge out of it, whereas I can. But I don't put great stock in an emotion I have, because I'm going to have another emotion and I enjoy them all.
So where does emotion fit into the five bodies model?
I would say all five bodies register emotion. I think emotion is consciousness.
Okay.
And I think you mean a certain associative emotion, maybe a bit of idea or assertion of your identity. That kind of emotion is what's your purposeful emotion, almost, in retrospect. It's like a particular kind of emotion that you're saying you like something. Well, everybody likes something, and what is significant about that? Why do we make an issue out of that?
Well, what I'm saying though is, yeah, everyone likes stuff, so I want to understand or try to understand.
Let me just
why do I like stuff? Like,
yeah,
a lot of people
I
don't
think,
care. They don't, you know, they don't. They're not going to read rock criticism because they don't care. They just like the music and they're
right. Here is the thing. I think I got it. Why are we more numb and not emoting? We think we're not getting any emotion, and all of a sudden something happens, like you have in the Meltzer interview. Is something going to happen? I don't know. Might happen, but I ain't looking for it in rock. This sense of something happening that's significant to you, that's rare for people because they're so stoned on the ecstasy, what Fittings Way called the mood mud of television, that they forgot fragmented emotion, a special emotion. So another way of saying that is, I'm picking up what you're saying, that you get an emotion, and then you realize, shit, I've been rather numb the last 3 weeks. You know, and let's look into what that numbness is. The numbness is actually a constant stimulation that you're used to. You actually need to bring in some strange, old scenario.
Right.
Like remembering when you were a kid and thought you were somebody before you became a working drone. That might be triggered by something. You could call it your identity. Isn't what you're saying is that we don't actually today register emotions too much, and everybody looks rather subdued, especially in New York City, when I was there all those years. They all look like zombies. Then something wakes them out of their zombiehood. And that's the kind of happening that Meltzer celebrated and Bang right. celebrated. And the contradictions is that they are looking for it in a virtual environment, an electronic environment, that is numbing people in general and making you need an emotional release or like a rocket ship to another space that isn't in the global discarnate implosion.
Right, okay.
Okay, isn't that what we're saying? Yeah. You're saying...
I think so. No, I think that makes sense. It's like, if I just relate it to pop songs or something like that, you know, you listen to a lot of stuff for, you know, whatever period of time, it's like, oh yeah, like I might walk around with my iPod on shuffle and be constantly flipping through songs, like, oh yeah, whatever, you know,
yeah.
blah, 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 and then all of a sudden it's like,
yeah.
shit, that's the one. And,
yeah.
And also, I literally will, if I'm going to work some days, I will replay a song 4 or 5 times. It's like, yeah, no, this, and I mean, I'm thinking about it too, though. I'm not just like, I mean, I guess I am drugged by it, but I'm also thinking like, I sometimes think, I want to, like, actually try and figure out why, like, what is it about this song that's doing it to me right now? And I might even head to my desk at work and actually jot down some thoughts about it, like, you know, the experience of listening to this song, or what is it in that, like, why did this song at this particular time grab me in such a way? I mean,
yes.
that to me is rock criticism. That's almost my definition of it. Like, what happened to me at this time listening to this song, and why was it so compelling or intriguing or screwed up or fucked up or whatever?
Right. And then you are then translating into another kind of emotion, the emotion, the mood of sitting down and trying to write it. See,
right.
that's an emotion too.
How is that an emotion?
Well, if you define emotion as interplay of mind, body, spirit or consciousness, and the sensory environment, people will go mind, body, spirit, but I add perception, the immediate technical environment around you, the environment of tools. You are thinking, okay, you're trying to translate the emotion the Walkman gave you into another medium. You want to look at it.
Right.
And categorize it within verbal terms in your head, meaningful statements, meaningful prose. And that is an emotion, too. If media environments are different states of consciousness, that is an emotion, too. So actually, when you know what I'm saying, I'm way more emotional than everybody because I notice how much emotion I'm engaging no matter what media environment I'm in.
Okay.
If I break down the boundaries of what emotion is.
Right, okay.
So it's good you said that. You're listening, and shifting, I heard that. Oh, this. Now, what's interesting is you can even see it in the Meltzer articles. And O'Brien's article, Autobiography of My Years, they are trying to figure out why they liked someone something at one time, and then 5 years later didn't like that and liked something else. This
right,
shifting
right.
And what you like changes. Like, you know, many times something I didn't like 20 years ago, I like now.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, but it's a different. I'm a different situation, different emotion, different reality. And for some reason that. It's almost like it's a massive MK-Ultra mind control program, and the central scrutinizer is sending out all these frequencies, and he knows that people will surf the different frequencies and react to one and don't like it, and then end up over in the other part of the frequency spiral, and like that, and then 2 years later, not like it, and go somewhere else. So we're bouncing within this incredible squirrel in a spinning cage, jumping off at different points and saying, yeah, this is what I like. And then if you notice how much you are changed and how your taste changed, then what you write when you what you wrote 5 years ago about something you would look at it and say, well, that was a unique experience. I wouldn't even respond to that song that way now, but I might write something about another song I didn't like 5 years ago this way right now.
No, precisely. I look at stuff I write all the time and think, oh, God.
yeah. And so what I'm saying is that is not something to be upset about. You have to realize you're living 200 years every 12 months. I was on KPFK last week with Jerry Fialka, and in the course of near the end of the thing, somebody was disagreeing with what I said, and I said, look, I changed 5 times during this interview. Don't quote what I said an hour ago. That's not the same person as who you're talking to now. See? So I'm changing that fast, and I'm trying to make people aware that they're changing that fast.
Okay.
So you use this idea 200 years, and so that's where if you're actually trying to write something down and finally get it right on paper, you're missing the ecstasy that you're going to be in for the next 20 years and the changes you're going to be put through. I mean, that's really what the intellectuals, the Dylan poetry came in, and it was starting to point out the changes. I'm younger than that now. Just pointing out the changes you're going through. Elvis never did that, but Dylan did, and that struck people. Oh, yeah, we're going through changes, and we can change faster. They did not read McLuhan and realize they were changing a lot faster than they even thought of. You know what I mean? But they could at least begin to notice, oh, I'm changing. And now it's a whatever kind of agreed-upon dogma principle that people go through changes. Yeah, they do this, they do that, they contradict themselves, you know, all these things. It's all accepted now. Wasn't accepted in the 60s that you would change that much.
Right, right.
Now, all this change, if you turn off the electric environment, you wouldn't change that much. So we're all cyber extensions of the change flood caused by incredible media turnover.
Okay.
So, here is Bangs and Kraftwerk. Let's go back to that quote. One guy says the machine is better than the hand, and then Bangs tries to one-up him saying, well, the hand, the nervous hand is not as good as
anything a hand can do nervously, a machine can do effortlessly.
Right. So is he slightly agreeing with Kraftwerk there, or saying, well, effortlessly is not cool because there's no effort there?
I think he's being a little cheeky, but I'm not sure. I think through that whole article, it's hard to say. I think he's kind of like
he's competing.
Competing with them. Yeah, I think he's trying to take everything they say a step further, maybe.
Because that's what he's going to do.
It's irrelevant whether he agrees or not. It's just he's kind of looking at it in a different way or something, or trying to look at it.
Yes, and he knows we're enjoying his cognitive interplay with them. We're watching the battle, the competition, and he's playing up to that. And that's why people like Dylan and anybody who becomes a big star who thought he wanted to put ideas out, he very quickly realizes that this is a post-information society. It's my idea is not the issue. It's when Time Magazine wants to interview me, they want to take a swipe at music. They want to take a swipe at the radio environment and prop up the medium of magazine writing. You see, there's McLuhan said there's a civil war among all the media. I mean, people think McLuhan, like TV, is so ridiculous. No. We're talking about a global theater and the media environments and their representatives and journalists and producers are all competing and being cagey with each other. In the TV shows, they put it into spy drama. But no, it's not spy drama. It's not fighting over a war or a terrorist group. It is the daily espionage of every medium going out there with their microphone and putting it in Dylan's face and say, hey, comment on this, because I need footage for my TV program.
Right, okay.
And after a while, as people got savvy to this in the 70s and 80s, then there's the competition. Everybody realized, well, no medium is more important than any other medium. We're all dancing about architecture, and that's great. So I'm going to wake up my aspect whenever I engage with something, and I'm going to compete with them because my stuff is as important as theirs because it all gets canceled out in the wash. In the Niagara Falls wash. So you see, Dylan and Nicholson, they don't get interviewed much because they know there's a game being played.
Right, right.
You know? And then others who are naive, Neufeld hears about this all the time, these new groups that come through and they get a little fame and they get interviewed and then they get all pissed off at what happened to them. They didn't get the correct coverage and then they react to that. That's a naivety that they don't teach in schools. They don't prepare the kids for what's coming, that they're in a monstrous, cannibalistic environment of information chewing up by every medium of every other medium. And And the only way you can get released from that is to turn up the volume. It's a very interesting statement by McLuhan that in the 19th and 18th century, music was had a corporate function, meaning a tribal or cultural function. It released people from the fragmentation that a literate society, just having books and newspapers, they couldn't get together. So they needed amazing music to unite them in the ear. Well, he said that in the 20s, or at least by the 60s, music was no longer a tribal corporate cultural event. It became a private concern. Now, that's a real interesting phrase. Private concern means that a literate individual consumer in the 20th century is going to prop up the old ear as an important part of his ID, his identity.
Right.
And that is what rock writing and why Rolling Stone and rock criticism kind of did. It became a cultural force as much as the old journalists and the old authors and novelists and movie makers thought it was a bunch of idiot kids. No. Cream and Rolling Stone matched with the literate kid the baby boomers need to hear an expression of music as a private concern.
Right.
And you know, by your time, kids argue. What's the main argument in high school and junior high is over what band you like and what crew.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
May
yeah.
not be that now, but it certainly was for 25, 30 years in the baby boomers Generation X.
Yeah.
You expressed your personal hipness or identity or nerdiness by what band you had. And by the 80s, it got that people were, because everybody lived 200 years every 12 months, they could see this pattern. So by high school, kids would purposely say they liked something just to have a different identity, to go against the tribe, right?
Yeah.
They didn't even like them. They pretended they liked the Smiths. Or what are those silly girls that couldn't sing? Were they the Smith sisters or something?
The Spice Girls?
No. The three girls, their father recorded them, and they can't sing, and they can't play the guitar. The Smiths?
Oh, not the Shags.
Maybe it's the Shags, yes, the Shags.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Three girls, right?
Yeah, exactly. Their father kind of like was kind of brutal and made them like make this music, and they didn't have a clue about what they were doing. And what critic actually liked them? Lester Bangs.
Yes, you see? And because, you know, you got to come up with a new angle to get attention every week when you're doing a column for the Village Voice or something.
Right.
And Metzer got tired of that. You know, he didn't, it could be personal. It could be his astrology sign. It could be personal background from his parents. Whatever his personality or temperament was, he got tired of that situation. So he went on and celebrated wrestling,
right,
and all kinds of other things. But Bangs was a fanatic. He stayed at the grind for 10, 13 years, 69 to 82, right?
Yeah, although he wavered a lot, and I think more and more, like the last couple of years in particular. You know, he kind of gave a lot of indications and hints that he was completely sick of it and didn't want anything. His last, there's this like yearly critics poll, the Village Voice, Paz and Jop poll.
Yeah.
And in his last ballot in, I think, 81, was basically just a complete sort of piss take on the whole process, like making up albums that were never released and, you know, saying he was only interested in old blues records and stuff like that, and no interest in remaining current and blah, blah, blah. So, of course, you know, after he died, there's... You know, there's always been a sort of a little side argument among rock critic fans, like, you know, would he have continued writing about music? Was he going to go on to something else? Whatever.
Well, that's why he committed suicide. He couldn't get out of that bind. You know, that's why he died. Because actually rock writing was more relevant to people because they would read it. They have to take a week off of life. I see it on the beach here. So many people reading as they're bathing on the beach down here. That's the only time they read, but they take a big vacation come here and they read a book. You know what I mean?
Right.
But they're reading reviews every day back on the mainland in the newspapers every day or on the online. They're reading quick reviews. Critics save people time. So here was Bangs, actually a very important public service what he was doing for the hyper entertainment lifestyle of New York. He's providing this thing, but it's killing him. And he wants to have an identity. He wants to become a literate left hemisphere novelist or something. And
right.
yet he's more important than novelists in terms of social function.
Yeah.
And he gets wiped out. Now here's where, you know, Meltzer went through the same thing. So Bangs arrived at Meltzer's state. Because Meltzer got in there early. He was right there when it was supposedly really great, 65 to 68, right?
Yeah.
But the here Meltzer is shocked at Grail Marcus and Christgau and Goldstein still doing it 30, 40 years later. They obviously have to be numb, zombies, right? They're inhuman. I mean, you know, if you're human, you would end up like Bangs. You'd check out after 13 years. How can they do it for this long? There's something being faked here.
Well,
there's something inhuman. There's no emotion there. Ah, but what is emotion? Christgau say, I have great emotions every day. I love what I hear. It's fantastic. And, well, how real is that emotion? Well, I wouldn't say it isn't real.
Well, I mean, if it was, sure, some of it may be a sense of being a replay or something, but I mean, if Christgau could still pull off a good column, you know what I mean?
In other words, we need to have someone write good columns to make to give meaning to what the 30 years of experience I've had this week. You know, I've processed a lot of movies and records and books and headlines and information, all this media. I got to get someone to give me the weather report. And so Christgau is there to sum it up.
Well, in some ways, I would say, yeah.
Yeah, that's their role. They are, as I say about John Stewart, John Stewart is worse than George Bush in terms of keeping this madness going, if you think this is madness. And a lot of people do think it's madness, right?
So why is he worse? I don't get that.
Beg your pardon?
I don't get why he's worse than George Bush. If you
because he gives us temporary meaning about the absurdity and mess that Bush is creating. If we didn't have a John Stewart, I mean, he's more important than the church. He's more important than the university. He gives these kids go and watch that news, and it has to be fake news because they know there's no real news. So fake news becomes a stability function for them. It gives them a sense of, oh, well, we're here. Someone's told me where it's at. They've made fun of that guy. Oh, it's good to abuse that person. All right. And so Stewart and Saturday Night Live satirize all this stuff. It is a necessary enema every week for people, every day now. And so how do you, and this is what I present to Ben all the time, how are you going to have a revolution, whatever one you want to have for your chemical body? How are you going to put a stop to this madness? Or maybe it's all great, so stop being depressed, Ben. Enjoy it all.
Yeah.
And Bush ain't a big problem. He's doing his part. He's providing bad scenes that John Stewart can make comedy out of. It's an amazing ecology of interpenetration. And that's where a point of view is ridiculous in that situation, or an ideology.
Okay.
Yeah, so John Stewart, what is he? As a matter of fact, someone was telling me John Stewart's getting a little... Yeah, your map was telling me this. That the other night, last week, John Stewart was shocked at how Fox is still getting away with its fantasy news.
Right.
and your map has heard me, and he knows that we're in a post-information society, and John Stewart's beginning to realize that. It doesn't matter what we're doing, what we say, what we satirize. They're not listening. They don't have to listen. And we're not going to wake people up to it. Those that want to engage in the Fox hallucination will continue.
Right.
So there's no no connecting. And there's no stable identity you can form. There's no idea that you can say was a good idea. It's medicinal. Robert Christgau is a doctor. Everybody's a doctor today. I call this the new medical unconscious. But that's an idea that requires extra listening in later hours, if you ever got the time.
Okay, let me read another quote from the Kraftwerk piece, because it's on the emotion topic, and maybe, you know, we've said enough about that. But so Bangs says, I told them that I considered their music rather anti-emotional, and Florian quietly and patiently explained that emotion is a strange word. There is a cold emotion and other emotion, both equally valid. That sounds like Richard Meltzer. It's not body emotion, it's mental emotion. We like to ignore the audience while we play and take all our concentration into the music. We're very much interested in origin of music, the source of music, the pure sound is something we'd very much like to achieve. It's really just the emotion part that I was interested in there. So
he sounded like me. I was trying
yeah,
to...
Yeah, yeah.
So they take a stance. This is in the mid-70s, right?
Yeah, 75 or 76.
Yeah, 34 years ago, a third of a century. But it doesn't seem... See, that's another aspect. With instant replay, none of this stuff seems that far ago. We can retrieve this stuff instantly, so it's still part of the present, and I've been known to have said, we never left 1945. we're still resonating the same pinhead of vibrational software consumption. Just been overlayered, layered over and over, more rich stuff that's always still there.
Right, right.
Kraftwerk is saying there's more than just whatever emotion you like, Lester.
Yeah.
You know,
cold emotion and other emotion, both
and the mental, and we could
body and mental, yeah.
Right? And we can broaden into that. There's emotions caused by our media extensions, or what we call the machines. They have evoked new emotions, and the traditional Platonic emotions or Christian emotions are too puny compared to the new emotions we're trying to express, because the machines are new parts added to our bodies. So it's actually, in my terms, Kraftwerk is saying, hey, Lester, we don't just have a chemical body. We got a TV body. We got an analog media body. And
right.
we want to engage the emotions and respond to that. And the chemical body audience is not that important to us.
Okay.
That's what he's saying. Like, we don't care. We don't play for the audience. So
yeah.
Ben is a Ben. So Lester is there as a...
And actually, in the same article, they mention how they turn their back on the audience. They don't care. So anyway, go on.
Yeah, and yet that appealed. People didn't feel insulted. I mean, they liked Miles Davis doing it back in the 60s when he turned on the audience.
Well, some critics reacted against it. Yeah.
Oh, there's always going to be a range of responses, but they still,
right.
Now Kraftwerk is like a huge icon. They were a great band, you know?
No, it's true, and now that period of Miles Davis is the exalted period. And at the time, the jazz establishment, you know, completely tried to shut it out or whatever, so.
Right, so always, new art, as McLuhan says, is always ugly. New forms of expression. So Kraftwerk was ugly at the time for most people.
Right.
But those that were, for whatever reason, to be hip or were hip, knew there was something being communicated by those guys turning away on us and ignoring us. That there's something to be said. They probably couldn't articulate it, or they did. And then they wrote it in their novel or the newspaper article or slammed their boss with it, you know. But at the next, you know, argument at the bar, well, you're into Frank Zappa. What about Kraftwerk? You know what I mean? Kraftwerk's where it's at, sir. And play a little game there with your boss. But and it's all leisure activity on the big level, right? Society has a lot of time in its hand. Everybody's got a lot of hand with the wealth of the 70s and 80s. A lot of leisure time to sit around and argue, but what consumption becomes a private concern. All right?
Okay.
And so so people are intrigued and fascinated by the environmental meaning of Kraftwerk. You see, people are always, they are closet media ecologists. People go and, you've heard many people probably say, I've heard it many decades, well, I don't like the new Hollywood movies, but I go there and see what the audience is into.
Right.
Everybody's always trying to figure out where the society is, and it's increasingly a virtual image. And that's why they watch Jon Stewart, to find out the virtual image, because TV is such an old medium, it's archetypal now, it gives a sense of community. So you find out what Jon Stewart says the audience is doing and what they satirize, and then you have a sense of where you are.
Right, right. Okay.
You see, the processing of this pattern recognition means that memory's not even important. McLuhan used to say that by the 70s, people knew that databases had more knowledge about themselves than they could remember, so they put on forgetfulness or amnesia as an art form, as a response, because the human's always ornery, always going to be different than whatever seems to be happening, just assert itself. And so we put on forgetfulness. And then that's become a norm now, the whatever. Can you imagine Charles Dickens being interviewed in 1850, or Karl Marx, and they ask him about something that's going on in India, and the workers are being pummeled and killed, and he goes, whatever, no way. He'd speak for 15 minutes with this impeccable prose.
Right, right. Okay. So here's one other thing. There's another quote from the Kraftwerk thing where they talk about synthesizers being referred to as cold machinery. And you know, I noticed that today even people still have a tendency to refer to certain musics as being cold or something.
Mm, yeah.
Meaning it's more like, you know, samplers. And synthesizers are considered cold, whereas a guitar is not considered cold. And I can't seem to make sense of this in trying to put it into... It doesn't seem to work for me with McLuhan's sort of hot and cold terminology, you know, which he obviously used more for television and stuff like that. What are people getting at, do you think, when they describe a synthesizer sound as being cold?
Well, I remember when I first heard the stuff in the 70s, I mean, what was it that Don Preston had on the Fillmore East album? He had a Moog. Moog was the first thing, right?
Okay.
And it sounded weird, and I remember not liking it completely. It was alien sound. It did sound hard, even though I'd listened to Sun Ra and Albert Eiler and Coltrane. It's actually, when you think of it, it was the beginning of the digitizing of music. You know how people many people insist the vinyl records are better. There's stuff lost in the digital. There was something about the digital, and I don't know if the Moog was a digital instrument, but it was starting to move that way, that was lost. And the only way people could articulate was it's cold. There was something missing. But, you know, you look at a generation, say, growing up in the 90s, what was cold to their parents is not cold to them. What is interesting is what they think is cold. You know, the 10-year-olds today or the 15-year-olds, what do they think is cold? It's probably totally bizarre what they think is cold.
Right.
You know, and so you look at the mix, the clothing, the technologies that they wore. So here we were in the 60s. We had analog TV. We heard about Sputnik and the satellites. We had FM radio. We didn't know anything about digital technology. We didn't know that the guy who invented the mouse was over there in Stanford with Stuart Brand demonstrating the mouse and early digital stuff for computers 20 years later. Unless you were, well, me and my buddy knew, because our job was to keep up on that. But I'm just talking about, even though I knew about it, I still had conditioned sensibilities. And so I hear the synclavier. I heard people, when I was living in Nova Scotia, at the art college, they had guys come in with weird, oscillators, And it was ridiculous. It wasn't entertaining, interesting at all. But if I stood back and said, okay, they're beginning to turn the electric analog media into an art form, just like Lewis and the constructivists turned the hardware machine into an art form in the 20s. Here you have the oscillator using digital technology turning and mutating the TV experience. The TV experience actually was an oscillator experience, but you didn't see it that way because you thought TV just had people and movies on it. So here you are using McLuhan's principle. You're moving into a new water. It's a digital. And so the old electric analog becomes art form. And that is usually too fast. Back then it was a slower time, too fast for people, so it just sounded cold. But now Kraftwerk sounds warm compared to whatever you can't take today.
Right, okay. You know the group, the Human League?
I remember them. I don't know much.
Okay, well, they're sort of out of the Kraftwerk mold, but they're a much more sort of poppy version. They were like a British, one of the early sort of synth pop bands.
Yeah.
They kind of took,
the early 80s, right?
Early 80s. They used all synthesizers, but, they were kind of writing songs more like almost in a Motown sort of.
It was almost like the irritation of the early 70s by the art students with their oscillators. Had by 10 years, people were now going to hear that if a little sugar was thrown in, they could take it. That's what you're describing.
Yeah, exactly. But this has been commented on before. But it's just one of those sort of, I don't know, things to meditate on or something. But Human League's Dare, which was one of the big albums of 1981, that was the album that was on Lester Bangs' turntable when he was discovered dead.
He just couldn't take it anymore. It was too cold. If music is going this way, I want to get out of here, It killed him. Probably people think, oh, he liked them and he was into them, wanted to write a review. No, it killed him.
Because he did spend so much of the last couple of years, especially, really, like, it's interesting because in that 75-76 piece with Kraftwerk, he's kind of like, well, I'm just going to say he's kind of actually warming to the idea of, like, synthesizers taking over and stuff, and although he's being kind of cheeky about it and stuff, he's kind of, like, glimmering something interesting in it that he feels, a pull towards. But by the time of, like, 79 or 80, he's, like, kind of become so dead set against almost any music that has this, like, sort of pristine, clean, technological...
That he created his own band and started screaming and yelling.
he reverted to listening to literally to nothing but like old blues records and stuff like that.
Like Meltzer.
The grain of the voice and all that.
Just like Meltzer says in your interview with him in 2000, I'm into the 20s blues. Into the blues.
Yeah.
Way back. He's killed
by the Human League's dare. So
yeah. We now know why Banks died. It's always been a mystery. It was the Human League. But back then, everybody thought he was like liking it or something. Now we have the perspective of thousands of years to look back at the changes people go through and how they eventually conk out and can't take it. That's interesting. If he was already objecting to that in 79-80, then Human League was like the popularization of that. It was too much. Oh, my God. Yeah. I lost. My movement failed to stop this. Okay, so you have the looking at the technological environmental mix, you can really figure out why things become mainstream. Like you can see that the speed up of the speed up of newspapers by 1820s or so, I don't know the exact decade, made people like lose their visual bias, left hemisphere decorum, and they actually went for the waltz. Did you know that the waltz was considered a radical anarchistic move?
Yeah, I've read that before, yeah.
Yeah, okay, so you look at the period, whenever it was, I mean, I could go quickly on Wiki, but I won't bother. You get the period, but you would look at the railroads are coming in, coaches, newspapers, and maybe the telegraph. Life is really speeding up for people, right?
Right, right.
And music is like the speech. You know, music is the language of the culture, altered, speeded up, slowed down. So in ancient cultures, it was Chinese music is so different because Chinese speech is so different from British speech, right? So the music's
right.
Different, but you're molded by your speech. So then when you use McLuhan and Joyce's insight that new technologies are new languages, they color the music. They change the music. So the music changed with the waltz, and then you had, what was that thing called at the turn of the century, the ragtime or the catwalk, or the, I forget what
Fox
they...
Foxtrot or something?
What'd you say?
Not the Foxtrot.
No, the... It's ragtime, whatever they...
Ragtime, yeah, like Scott Joplin and stuff is like 1905.
Yeah, right? Now you see footage of that. You see the flappers or the flippers or the clappers, whatever
right,
they call them, you know, dancing. And they were considered wild maniacs, you know, and they're just jumping up and down. But the speed up, okay? The music has to get faster. Okay,
right.
So they're not using visual waltz decorum anymore and how you step in your dance step. It's just move fast, right? Okay,
right.
So then you get in the radio era in the 20s and 30s. And obviously the bordello music, the whorehouse music, the speedy music of the blacks and the blues fits the rhythms. And that becomes Louis Armstrong and jazz.
Right, right.
And that is, you know, imagine Queen Victoria, if she was alive at that time, or her husband, Prince Albert, whatever he was. They'd think that was like everybody's on Terrence McKenna's ayahuasca or something, right? They're just shocked by this. But... These are new generations growing up with it. They got to adapt to the rhythm. They're gonna dance faster. They're gonna dance faster to the architecture. And the architecture is the linguistic technological structure that's molding the senses of the people. And music is a translation of that language. All right, it's a perspective, a way of looking at it. Okay, so then you have jazz, and then and that's the radio era. And then all of a sudden, TV comes in the 50s. The jazz guys are saying, "Hey, nobody wants to hear us anymore." And they don't have the detachment to say, well, that's because the environment's been changed. The government released a new medium. The sensibilities are changed. And our music ain't gonna do it. You know, it's not fast enough or it doesn't have the right timbre. It's too shiny. You get TV and the black and white image and the tactile, guttural, mood mud effect of television. Obviously, an Elvis kind of music is gonna be more appropriate to what people are really feeling, though they're not that conscious of it. The music actually seems amazing because it's translated their experience.
Yeah,
and they don't see. They just see. Oh, I like the way he moves his hips. He's handsome. I'll get laid with this music. You know, it's all this what McLuhan called user as content. You put your own chemical body bias into it. But if you stand back and look at the sociology, you can understand. Okay, so then That's TV, black and white. Then you bring in color TV and satellites and video in the beginning of video cameras, but that's the late 60s. But anyways, in the mid-60s, it is incredible, a global theater. Everybody's doing their own thing. Music's got to get louder. The ear has to be heard. It's got to get louder.
Right.
Psychedelic rock. So then you get the prog rock of the 70s, right? And
yeah.
Then you get disco. And disco is the globe made into that ball, the disco ball, is like the planet, totally inside the global theater, but it's been shrunk now by digital answer machines and all that by the late 70s. And so Studio 54 and disco takes over, and that mania is appropriate for the sensory needs. And what is it? It's millions of people in a big room just thumping away, right?
Yeah.
And no interest in melody or whatever you want to call the great Motown sound of the 60s or blues. I remember in the late 70s, you know this, I was listening to As It Happens, and a couple of famous musicians, Muddy Waters or something, were interviewed by Barbara Frum about how they couldn't get gigs in the clubs anymore. Disco taken over.
Yeah.
And that probably helped Louis Farrakhan. Oh, this is racist. White man's killed our music. Okay, that's a racist thing. But it wasn't. It was a technological effect. So then you have... punk in reaction to that, because by that time kids are not going to conform as much. You're actually so fragmented by the satellite environment that you actually will be start to be different on purpose. So punk fits in the people that don't want to be involved with disco, right?
Right.
Like you didn't have, did you have a in the 50s, as Meltzer was, you went back to jazz if you didn't like Bobby Darin in the early 60s. You did. You had a call and response, and you could go back to another kind of music. But maybe also, I mean, industrial culture. They had pub music in the 19th century, and they had vaudeville, and then they had the courtly. Well, so probably was, you know, class levels of musical response or ideology in the music you chose. But it gets more frenetic after World War II because music becomes a public concern. You could say in the 19th century, the pub music was a class, and the waltz was another class, and they weren't. It wasn't a private concern. It's just that the classes didn't mix. But after World War II, the classes are mixing, and then people's identity has to come into it, and it's almost like an astrological sign. So, Miles and them provided an environment to rock and roll with jazz, and then Coltrane came in to provide an environment to all that by just playing noise. And then you have Meltzer, Bobby Darin stuff, and Meltzer goes back to jazz. But then rock hits his G-spot, the Beatles for some reason, and he's released again. He jumps into that stuff.
Yeah.
And his rock criticism is a diary of music being a private concern for his identity, because he doesn't want to deal with the McCormick Finnings Wake tactile environment. That would be real perception to actually deal with that. But you don't expect a 25-year-old to do that. They got to live their life. As McLuhan says, they're just vegetables, these kids. Let them grow. Slow evolution. Slow progress. By the time they're 50, they'll understand what I'm talking about. But can't get them when they're 20. Let them have their millennial ecstatics and enjoy the Doors and Jim Morrison and blow their brains out with their drugs and herpes. You get in the satellite environment, the digital environment, the personal computer comes in the early 80s, TV becomes an art form. And so TV and MTV takes over. So video, it didn't kill music, it became the new music.
Right.
It became tactile environment as entertainment. The ear was gone. Okay, if you're a sentimentalist for the ear, you're going to be upset about that, like Meltzer and them. But young kids, they live in that water. It's real. So how are you going to respond to that? Well, you start, heck with even making any music, just start yakking and ranting and put as much imagery in what you're saying as fast as possible and rhyme it.
Yeah.
Hip-hop shows up as the environment to that.
Yeah.
And that's not even music for people of older sensibilities. What the hell is that?
Yeah.
And you can see that the speed, if you've got these kids growing up in the 70s, 80s, and they're getting all this TV and information blatting at them, way more than the 50s and 40s and 60s people, what are they going to do? They're going to just cram images as much as possible and do it as fast as possible. Why bother learning to play guitar? Just say it. And you just verbalize it and cram all this imagery in. That's keeping up. Rap is faster than psychedelic rock because you've got to cram all the images in. Has anybody ever explained this before? I have, but this is the best explanation for why rap becomes important. Because you can get more information in there faster.
Well, and there's the, I mean, to tie it into the Chuck D quote from Public Enemy saying rap is black people's CNN.
Yes, black people's CNN. Now, isn't that interesting? There's he has that perspective because he lives it and he's creating the art form, but he doesn't have the larger, more mature detachment that he's saying it's our CNN, but is it revolutionary to be a CNN?
Yeah, well, yeah.
That they can't go that far. You can't get that detached. No, we're gonna save our people. We're gonna get rid of white man or whatever we're gonna do. We're gonna go back to Africa. All that tribalism is the only chemical body response. But the CIA and the real managers of society, like I was on, the Tetrit managers, they're looking at this all across the globe and just saying, oh, let them have their little mini revolutions. Let them think that they're being black. A black person isn't black anymore, isn't black by the time you have television because they got a TV body laid on them. And they're not just black, they're whatever you want to call the TV body. What color is that? You know what it is? It's the color of the band you worship. That's what color it is, the music band you're into. Hey, that's a good statement. And look at in this decade, the kids speed it up even more with their Facebook. Or remember MySpace? You go there and they list 1,000 movies, 1,000 records, all their whole profile of old analog media. That was what they were.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? A total super collage of all this consumption of different older media. That was That's who they were. Looks like a page of Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you can see that. Plato said? What did he say? If I change the music, I change the republic. Something like that. It's a famous quote. See, Plato was a mime. He was an oral tribal guy. But he got the alphabetic bug and went I. He turned into Wyndham Lewis and didn't like oral music, which he was an expert in, and developed the idea of the republic, where a visually biased philosopher king would drive the oral poets and the musicians out of the republic.
Okay.
And so there is a quote from Plato, something like the Fugs quoted in one of their late 60s.
I don't know it, actually.
Yeah, it's that when the music changes, then the society changes.
Okay,
so that is in a slower time. When the technology changes, the society changes, and so does music as a subset of the technological change.
Okay.
And that's what I'm showing in my chart. I just list all the... I just say, 50s, jazz, 60s, Elvis and the Beatles, later 60s rock, then disco, then rant and hip-hop. I just name them. You can say, well, you're just listing what happened. Yeah, but if you look at the other part of the chart, I'm showing the technological ground that made that music popular.
Right, right. Okay.
I mean, McLuhan said in the 60s, if tactility is extended by the global theater and television, and we're numb by tactility, the older senses, the eye, ear, nose, and foot, will counter that by becoming hyper. So we had hyperkineticism, why World of Sports in the 60s, watching surfers and car races, okay? That's hyperkinetic space going hyper. You had loud music. You had hyper visuality in the arts or whatever in movies. And you had hippies being stinky. Hyper smell. Anyways, all the old senses went into hyper mode to react to the void, the black hole that tactility is. Because tactility is the interplay of senses, not any particular sense. So McClure would sit there and he'd be aware. He did a Life magazine article. His book, Cultures Are Business, he quoted Richard Goldstein's article on the new music that was in Life magazine in the summer of 60 or something. The summer of 68. He would just look at what's happening in magazine culture, what's happening in music, what's happening in sports. He'd just look at the whole thing, and he knew that they'd all have the same characteristics as the hidden medium that no one noticing, and the hidden medium was a satellite at that time. You mean the whole thing about doing your own thing? The reason, I mean, that. Housewives started saying that by the 80s. It became a norm. but it was outrageous in the 60s. But really, to do your own thing was to get off the planet and the media complex and to sail around the planet like a satellite. So doing your own thing was, I'm going to be not a machine, I'm going to be a satellite. I'm going to ignore all the media tribalism. And of course, that got swallowed up by digital reality, and then that gets canceled, but it's a passing fancy. So when I reread these articles, to me, there's scientific evidence of the mood mud that was caused by technological phases at that time.
Okay, okay.
So we could begin to go into them, unless there's some other aspects.
Well, Bob, but the only thing is, I've got to kind of watch, like, what's the possibility of us continuing this conversation another time, too?
No, we'll continue until we finish. It might take 5 sessions. I have no problem.
Yeah, okay. Okay, no, that's good, because I don't even feel I'm a quarter of the way through.
Oh, no, we'll go indefinitely. This could go on.
An eighth of the way through the stuff, but I actually do have to get out of bed probably in about 5-6 hours.
Oh, okay, so what's this, the Bob and Scott? Bob and Scott.
Sure.
Bob
sure.
And Ben, okay. Bob and Scott. We'll counter this to Ben. We'll send these to Ben and see.
If it's a mini series or whatever,
that's good.
No, but this is awesome. And like I've got, like I say, I've got notes on a lot of this stuff. And I think in terms of the stuff I sent you, we've only actually gotten through some of the bangs. So we haven't even really touched on.
We haven't started.
Quotes and all. Yeah, we haven't started.
We haven't started. This was all just me saying my punchline. It's like Finney's Wake, the same message on every page, but I have to keep cycling around to figure out what's meaningful to the audience or to you,
Yeah.
Okay. McLuhan had a line, let me repeat what I was about to say. That's what our next thing will be. We're going to repeat what we were about to say.
Okay, that sounds good.
Okay, Scott, cool. Well, this has been very good. I liked it. And so you've got to go right now, so I'll keep I'm going to hang up, and I'm going to call Scott Norris back, and we'll talk about it. It's always good to
sounds
get Scott's,
good.
Scott Norris's view of this. So very good. I don't know if it'll be next Monday or what day, but Scott is good on Sundays and Mondays. That's good for you?
Yep, those are both good for me. So
maybe we'll do a Sunday.
Yeah, let's be in touch between now and then.
Yeah, just by email, keeping up, and we'll continue. Yeah, we've just started.
Sounds good, Bob.
Although they've probably all fallen asleep.
Yeah, I know.
But we're into it. We're creating our own space in a post-information society.
Exactly.
Okay, talk to you later, Scott.
Thanks, Bob. Bye.
Bye.